Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. Folks, welcome back. And it is now or never. That debt is fraud. We don't owe a penny of it. And your campaign begins now. I'm going to jumble them up a little bit. And don't forget to make your appeal to heaven, but you need to learn what we need to do, which is why we cover the content. I know most people just don't have the luxury and time to sit down and start reading these source documents. But if you want to understand what the Constitution means, how they designed it, why they designed it the way they did, these are the documents that will actually give you that insight. And so you learn, pray, and act, right? Make sure you make that appeal to heaven. And then on top of that, what we also are appealing to you is as we start to move forward in our efforts and so forth, what we would like to do is actually, you know, get everybody to start focusing on constitutional compliance. Don't forget, if the Department of Justice was retooled, if your attorney general was retooled, if your local county prosecutor and our justice system actually became non-corrupt or gave up its corruption and said, we are going to demand everybody to comply to their oath instead of dealing with this whole swamp that they have created. When I say they, the judiciary was the real source for most all of these problems, because it's very appealing. And as a matter of fact, welcome back, Tammy.
Thank you.
I find it very appealing to human nature to be able to obtain greater power. In other words, as you're standing there and you realize that the sword in your hand may be 18 inches long, a good dagger, but you see that somebody's left a sword leaning against some wall and it's not yours, but boy, if you had that sword, you'd have a 4-foot, you know, blade, and how much more power you'd be able to exert with that blade. And so forth and so on. As they started discovering more ways to be able to assume more power and do more, it made them feel better. It's just human nature to try to do things that they can do more. And, oh, by the way, there's this other little human nature problem that most people think, well, it's okay to do this. Even though we don't have the authority, it's for the greater good. Ah, that little devil for the greater good. Because bottom line, had we lived by the system as designed and had we lived by the paradigm that was cast, as the die was cast by the framers in establishing this, if there was a way to, you know, think, well, we'd do better if we could do the Department of Transportation. And had they amended the Constitution properly, then they would only be doing those things that they amended in the Constitution to do. And had they followed that, and had they actually maintained the proper relationship between the states and the federal and the states, then they would have actually kept each other from going astray. But honor amongst thieves is what it is. And opportunists are opportunists, and they never let a crisis go to waste, if that makes sense. You know the subtext of that? Never let a crisis go to waste?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So because that was Rahm Emanuel that was cited for that. And, you know, he's not the only one. I mean, that's just typical. That's just The means justify the ends. That is a progressive, non-law-abiding paradigm. the means justify the ends. So anyway, we're going through the notes on the Constitutional Convention, and we're just now on Friday the 13th of July diving into the admission of new states. The reason this is so important, folks, is that when states joined the Union, they were to have full sovereignty. Now, actually, I'm going to go down a little rat hole because this is actually happening in America today regarding immigration. Where is the delegation in the Constitution regarding immigration? Do you know?
Say again.
Where in the Constitution is there a delegation of power? Who has the authority per the Constitution to manage and control the immigration into America?
Congress?
No.
The states?
Oh, so when we read the Constitution, the Constitution being as clear as, you know, anybody can make it, when we read Article 1, Section 8, the only thing that the federal government had the responsibility is to ensure that a uniform rule of naturalization was established and maintained. When we look at the Articles of Confederation, how many times did the word immigration pop up? None. Continental Congress did not have any authority in managing and regulating the importation of persons and or the migration of people. Importation means that the state goes out and gets. In other words, we're going to go out and we want to bring in all of these people. And let's look at it in today's modern times. We actually see the importation of persons being executed by the federal government, and they're called refugees.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when we look at Article 1, Section 8, the federal government only has the authority to establish a uniform rule of naturalization. In other words, folks, states, here is how you will basically follow this process of making those immigrants or those people within your state to become U.S. citizens. So technically, when this Constitution was being ratified, at that point in time, the states possessed all authority over the migration of persons and the importation of persons, period. At that point in time, and when the Constitution was being written, and as a matter of fact, you got the document right there. Just, we kind of know where we are. So instead of me doing it, let's let you do it. Why don't you do a search in the document for immigration?
You're talking about the color-coded?
No. I'm talking about the notes on the Constitutional Convention.
Okay.
Immigration.
There's one?
Only one instance. Now, let's try migration. Now, migration comes up 14 times, right?
Yep.
Okay, so that's what they're talking about. And so when we look, we're going to go through this real quick for you folks. So when you actually look at the first instance, and I'm going to go all the way up to the very first instance, you'll find that it actually comes up. What day is this? June 25th. This is Mr. Pinckney, and he says, I'm just going to kind of encapsulate what he's really talking about here. He's talking about, because in a new country possessing immense tracts of uncultivated land, where every temptation is offered to immigration, that's with an E, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, and where industry must be rewarded. So there's no talking here. It's kind of just theory and principles and so forth. So it wasn't talking about the federal government having any authority over immigration. So now let's try the next time. It comes up with Mr. Gary. And this happens to be July 14th. And we're going to be reading this. So, and it comes up as, if some of our children should remove others, we'll stay behind. And he thought it incumbent on us to provide for their interests. There was a rage for immigration from the eastern states to the western. So it's not talking about the federal government having it. It's just talking about this natural immigration from the eastern states moving west. Because that, and this is where I've mentioned this before, I've brought up the fact that the plantation owners in the eastern states, from Georgia to the Virginia or what have you, these large plantation owners were migrating their family as a franchise westward. As a, you know, because all these, everybody back in those days had large families. And so every son, and sometimes the daughters who married sons, because these plantation owners were very wealthy, they would go buy land and help, you know, get their family kickstarted in actually having their own plot of land. And the person that would inherit the original plot would be the first son, because that's how things worked. But the fathers usually being caring or actually wanting to perpetuate this institution of slavery and this this opportunity to have a subclass of royalty. If you think about it, you know, these families became very wealthy. We're already aware, because they've been talking, that the South had the money. And so these wealthy doers were basically not only, you know, trying to maintain and grow this, I'll just say, a subclass of royalty in America, they also were amassing affluence. Does that make sense? Because they had money, they could start injecting in politics. They had so much affluence, it was their affluence that forced the Missouri Compromise. And so, let's just keep going, though. So that was the second point of emigration. Now it talks about migration. And this is where they're actually talking about the Constitution. This is August 6th, when the Constitution is forming. And it says, Section 4, no tax or duty shall be laid by the legislature on articles exported from any state, nor on the migration or importation of persons, as the several states shall think proper to admit. Explain what that part says. Nor on the migration. So they're talking about no tax or duty shall be placed on the migration or importation of such persons as the several states shall think proper to admit. Does that mean that the federal government is going to be able to control immigration? It wasn't even in the design. You see my point? Okay, so nor shall migration or importation be prohibited by the federal government. Okay, now that's the fourth, going to the fifth. Mr. Randolph talks problematic whether the immigrations to this country were on the whole useful or not. So just getting into theory on it. So let's look at the sixth application. America was indebted to immigration for her settlements and prosperity. In other words, this was something they needed to make sure they did. This was Madison talking about it, that this immigration was critical for growing this nation into what it was. Mr. Wilson cited Pennsylvania as a proof of the advantage of encouraging immigrations. Okay, now we're getting into on page 1345. This is Colonel Mason talking about immigration. They prevent the immigration. This was the one point in time where it was actually spelled out properly. They prevent the immigration of whites who really enrich and strengthen our country. In other words, this is where he's actually talking about this compromise that was affixed to the Constitution. Because look what day it is. This is Wednesday the 22nd. And this is where we're actually going to read what he says, because go ahead, you're going to see this in the red. Go ahead and read if you're right there with me. Are you there with me?
Yeah, every master.
Yes, every master. Go ahead, read this famous statement that he says.
Every master of slaves is born a petty tyrant. They bring the judgment of heaven on a country. As nations cannot be rewarded or punished in the next world, they must be in this. By an inevitable chain of causes and effects, providence punishes national sins by national calamities.
Okay, so what he's basically talking about with regarding immigration, was really the focus, that the South was deliberately bringing blacks for the purpose of slavery. You know, because it was being stated that, you know, it was better that we immigrate and bring more white people here, because we know what's going to happen if they're bringing blacks. It's just going to perpetuate slavery. And they needed to get away from that. They wanted to get away from that. And it was this day when they finally made the compromise that slavery would be retained to appease the southern states, those three southern states. Okay, so let's go a little bit further and find out what the ninth instance is. And so this actually is a quote, and this is on August 24th, and it says, strike out much of the fourth section as was referred to the committee and insert, quote, the migration or importation of such persons as the several states now existing shall think proper to admit shall not be prohibited by the legislature, Congress, prior to the year 1800, but a tax or duty may be imposed on such migration or importation at a rate not to exceed the average of duties laid upon imports. In other words, this is where they're pounding out the federal government's ability to start prohibiting the importation of slaves. Now, Mr. Wilson had already talked about, you know, let's call it what it is. Let's say this is the importation of slaves. Let's not call it migration or importation of persons.
Yeah.
And it was the South that said, no, we don't want that word in here, because they knew that the abolition movement was well underway. And when we get to the ratification debates, we will prove this to you. Because the southern states brought it up in the ratification debate, said, hey, look at the North. They're actually abandoning and getting and freeing their slaves. We cannot allow this, you know, to drag on. We need to get into this, because we actually have the preservation of slavery if we get into the system. If we fail to join, they're going to actually outlaw it. And then later on, if we have to join the Union because of harassments from Europe, then we're going to have to surrender. So that was one of the reasons South Carolina and Georgia basically rubber stamped it. But South Carolina basically pushed forward. North Carolina was more apprehensive. Anyway, so let's finish up these. That was the ninth. And on the such migration, so we covered those two instances there. So the 11th instance is basically the same thing, but this is actually how it starts forming in the Constitution, the migration or importation of such persons. So in other words, have you seen anywhere here where the federal government was going to control the migration of persons in this Constitution?
Mm-mm.
So why is it that everybody believes that the immigration of people is a federal issue?
Yeah, I don't know.
Does the federal government need migrant workers to come up and paint buildings and put roofs on? Or do they need, you know, migrant students to come and learn from them, because every word that comes out of their mouth is considered gold? In other words, everybody wants to know what they have to say because they're so enlightened. In other words, my point is that when people come to America, it is not because of Washington, D.C. It has nothing to do with the federal government, other than the fact that today and over the past half century, if not longer, so it goes all the way back to the 50s under Eisenhower. Eisenhower ended this concept, and actually he executed what was previously known as Operation Wetback. And I'm not trying to be racist here. That's what they called it. And Ike was the guy. And if you read Petition 3, we actually point out that he deported over 1 million migrant workers that came and stayed and said, we're going to get this cleaned up. And they did. And they got rid of most everybody. The problem was that the federal government did it instead of the states doing it. because at that point in time, the militia had been completely perverted because Ike and all the army guys, they loved to have all that extra power because of the opportunities in the ranking structure of a large army gives everybody an opportunity to make more money. Anyways, as I rant a little bit here, so forgive me, folks. The point, in fact, is this, that when we're looking at immigration in the Constitution and why this document is so critical, because when we get to the ratification debates, guess what they don't talk much about? Immigration. Because the states have full leisure and control over the migration of persons. The only thing the federal government has the authority to do is to actually ensure that as the states make the, you know, allow people to become citizens, they actually have to follow the uniform rule of naturalization. And so the problem is the federal government has been weaponizing this migration for a long time. They've been violating the Constitution for a long time by actually importing refugees. They don't have that authority. That came from another treaty that was equally unconstitutional as the original treaty in joining the UN. But the importation of refugees is a treaty that the United States got involved in, and I believe it was in the late 50s or early 60s, when they concocted this plan that they were going to start really pushing the cultural boundaries of the United States by importing more and more and more people. Now, when they brought the Vietnamese into America in the late 60s, 70s timeframe and into the 80s, the Vietnamese actually loved liberty. They came here and they kind of integrated themselves as good citizens. We, you know, there were some gangs and those types of things, but most of the Vietnamese that I've ever met were really good people. And it's the same thing with some of the Chinese that have come here, so forth and so on. So as we look at the migration, we really started making big mistakes when we actually started migrating, or I should say importing, enemies of the United States. And those were those coming from Islamic states, because they don't want liberty. They want Sharia law. They want to inflict their religion and theocracy upon us and the world. And so bringing them in here was completely antithetical to the, you know, the whole purpose of the federal government, because they were to preserve our liberty. They were to safeguard it and not allow enemies to actually come here. Enemies of liberty, enemies of the Constitution, because show me any group of Muslims that are organizing themselves and pushing for Sharia law, how they're supporting the Constitution. They're not. They're actually enemies of the Constitution because they want to inflict Sharia law. In other words, they should lose their citizenship and they should be deported, because they're not willing to support the supreme law of the land. Their supreme law is Torah, or not Torah, I'm sorry, the Quran and the Hadiths. And so, okay, well, we want them to feel comfortable following their supreme law, so we need to deport them back to the state they came from, or to a state which would help harbor them and let them allow to live in their world of Islam. But it's not coming here. It can't come here. Anybody that allows it to come here is actually violating their oath as a citizen and responsibility of safeguarding us from those types of things. I may not be popular, and I may really upset everybody in one way or the other, but the facts are the facts. And so when we look at immigration, we do not have an immigration system the way it's designed. The states actually should have the control. Why is it that we've allowed? Well, we're running out of time here, so let's go into a break here. And with that, we'll talk a little bit more about immigration. Then we'll get back into the notes on the Constitutional Convention. So this is one of the reasons why we just covered this, and now we don't have to do the details of this. Immigration is not going to be detailed in this, nor is it in the Constitution, because the states had full authority over the migration and importation up until 1808 with slaves regarding that. We'll be right back. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so in all humility, can you help me? What's the best way of saying this? I don't want to say, see, I told you so, I'm right. But can you help me understand how we've been so ill-informed? Welcome back, Tammy.
No. I mean, I don't know. We just stopped teaching it in schools. We stopped teaching it. I don't know.
Okay, so I think we have gotten to a point where we have completely accepted this royalty of the federal government, this unlimited federal government. And that we have actually, as I look at the people, the Republicans, as long as we're in charge, we're okay of the system that is controlled by the parties. In other words, when you look at our form of government, we have a corporate form of government. We have a judiciary form of government because the legal system, everything is being fought out in the legal system. Our legal system at the federal and state level is limited to those powers delegated. They don't have the power of marriage. They don't have the power of family and you know, health and all of those types of things. Almost everything that has been inflicted upon us has come from the federal government as they've assumed these powers because nobody stood up and said, stop. Because the people that we call the greatest generation, most of them are dead now, but the people we call the greatest generation allowed the federal government to roll over them and give them a social security system. Right?
Yeah.
It began a long time ago. And even though at that point in time, the indoctrination, the inculcation of Americans was not what it is today. In other words, they were at least learning a little bit about this limited and defined government. But they weren't really learning it, or they would rather just allow everything to move forward because the system by that point in time had been so perverted. The court system had become so perverted. In 1920, the Scopes trial basically created the opportunity for the federal courts to create law and to mandate evolution be taught in the schools when the Constitution clearly states that they shall make no law respecting religion. Mm-hmm. In other words, the fact that they said you can't teach creation, you can only teach this, is a law respecting religion.
Right.
So, it's, you know, I sleep well at night because I finally got past all of these problems and I understand where the real problem lies. And I'm just sitting here, you know, there's a friend used to always poke at me. because I always seem to be the contrarian, the odd guy out. And actually, he was a Marine friend, and he was the guy, I've mentioned him before, never mentioned his name, but he's the guy that came back to me years later and said, you know, GR, you were right. I was wrong. But he would always poke at me going, oh, well, you've proven you're right, and nobody likes you because you've proven you're right and we're wrong. All alone in Wrightsville, huh, there, GR? How's that make you feel? And I'm okay. I'd rather be right and die, you know, on the right side than die in the wrong position, holding the wrong argument or standing for the wrong thing. And so, this is a personality flaw of mine. And even though I've never, just to be honest, I've never actually gone through, I've looked at immigration. I knew immigration only came up once as it's spelled. And then I spelt it with you, migrate. Well, let's look at migration, because they do talk about the migration of persons. And so, voila, it came up 14 times. But I knew that based on the Constitution and kind of reading through this in general and going through the ratification debates, that the topic of immigration was never talked about, because had it been talked about, the anti-federalists would have used that as a point of contention to say, look, these guys can actually, down the road, if they're controlling immigration, they can decide, you know, the wrong people to come here. Mm-hmm. And think about that. That's exactly what they're doing. They have been, over the past half century, deliberately weaponizing the wrong people by bringing here, giving them the ability to be indolent. And as a matter of fact, most of those people that had migrated or been brought here illegally since the 90s, they're not liking what they're seeing. Because the new class of people being brought here are actually, you know, under this entitlement idea. Back in the 90s, 80s, late 80s, 90s, when it started picking up after Reagan's amnesty, those people just, they wanted to come here to have the opportunity. So they learned and those types of things, but they were still here illegally. And they've been here illegally the whole time. And now they're at a point, and America is at a point. What do we do? And as a matter of fact, you know, before we get back into where we were, what do we do? What do we do, Tammy? We've got so many. I'm telling you that we probably easily have over 50 million invaders.
Mm-hmm.
So what do we do? Do we actually hold the law and start deporting? Well, yes, what the law states. Right? I mean, until heaven parts open and says you can have same-sex marriage, if you want to live by God's law, you follow God's law. So I guess the real point I'm trying to make here is that because our law, the law of the land, says that all invaders must be repelled. That's what the Constitution demands, that the federal government and the militia, which means every state should be using their militia to actually gather up all invaders and send them packing. Now, when you think about it, based on the design of the original militia, because we're going to get into this with the ratification debates, but when you look at the design, that means that the counties, the sheriff, is the commander of the county militia, and it is the sheriff's duty to pack up and grab every migrant, or I should say invader, and if they're not here legally, identify them, and if they've been here for a long time and they've got, I mean, we literally have to scrutinize everything to ensure that we're following the law. So, and I'm going to tell you that this law is not inhumane. this law needs to be followed, and the concepts of amnesty and the concepts of forgiveness shouldn't be applicable. But the reality is this, that as we start deporting these people out of America, and they're people that have been here for a long time, going back to Mexico and what have you, the real solution is actually having those nations, you know, come, I'll just say it, come to Jesus on the fact that if they want to live in the land of liberty, they have to make their state, their nation, a state or a part of a state that joins the Union. Now, when you look at Mexico all the way down to Venezuela, when we look at where that, you know, that little cusp is that, you know, separates North America from South America, then we should actually be saying, okay, Mexico and all of those borders, you know, because when you think about it, why is it that those other little nations didn't become a part of Mexico? Because they had their own little power bases and everything else. Now, and the reason why they should actually be a state within Mexico or a county or a subgroup, a culture, is because coming into the United States, it's not about creating a class of cultures that are all equal. It's ensuring that the Union actually be properly divided. And so they come into the Union once everybody has actually got English and they're practicing the laws, then they're admitted into the Union, which would take decades. And then down the road, it would probably take another century or so before the whole of Mexico starts dividing into sub-states. Because by them understanding the law and growing and so forth, they can actually start applying the principles of liberty and good self-government to determine where their differences really lie, because you'll probably find that Mexico will probably be more divided than the Southern, or I should say Latin America, would be divided the way it is today. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So the point is that our foreign policy needs to be what it should have been all along. If you and your people in your nation want to enjoy liberty, you need to admit, or basically submit yourself or submit a request to become a state in the United States. That's what we should be sending out to Hong Kong, Taiwan, every nation in the world. If we did this, then this would actually create a real threat for the internal security of China and Russia. Because when they actually say, you know what, we don't have to live like this. We could actually, you know, become a state in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm telling you that there are lots of people in China that would love to see a regime change. Lots of people. Lots and lots of people. Because Tiananmen Square would be actually, you know, would be revisited on steroids, because now they know that if they can have an honest and open election, they can actually choose to turn down communism and actually open up a life. Because you think they like living in the social credit system where the state control? They're trapped now.
Yeah.
They're absolutely trapped unless they can see the opportunity that was never presented to them because the Bushes were globalists. And whether they liked it or not, whether the Chinese liked it or not, they were heading down a path of being enslaved to their government, because that's exactly what happened. The globalists got their way, and they were able to establish the test bed to be deployed throughout the world. Folks, it's coming here. The social credit system is coming here.
Yeah.
Unless we do something about it now. And it has to be done by demanding full compliance. You let the little devil into the room by saying, well, we'll allow those little things. Political correctness will be our demise. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't think that there was political correctness in heaven. because you couldn't you couldn't hide your agenda, right? You know, like today, we can actually be deceitful, we can lie, and so forth. I don't think we could, in heaven, I don't think you can lie. I think you actually have to take your position, and you stand there, and because it's easy to hide or be deceitful or what have you in this life. But I think it's different in heaven. And so that's one of the reasons why people had to choose, you know, for themselves, you know, what they wanted to do, which caused that war in heaven. Anyway, before we dive further and further away from the notes on the Constitutional Convention, let's go ahead and pick up with Mr. Gary on admitting new states. And again, folks, this is the 13th of July. Go ahead.
Did you want me to
read ahead
after in convention?
Admission of the new states, prop represent. So this is about property representation and the admission of new states. That's what we're looking at. This is
I don't think I'm at the same spot.
Okay, so Friday, July 13th, and you go down 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 to the 11th. It's actually admission of new states, prop, and represent.
Okay. Finding that the loss of the question had proceeded from an objection with some to the proposed assessment of direct taxes on the inhabitants of the states, which might restrain the legislature to a poll tax, moved his proposition again, but so varied as to authorize the assessment on the states, which would leave the mode to the legislature. At this caret insert the words interlined, that from the first meeting of the legislature of the U.S., until a census shall be taken, all monies for supplying the public treasury by direct taxation shall be raised from the said several states according to the number of their representatives respectively in the first branch.
Okay, so the taxation would be based on the apportionment. So it would be levied out based on population. So the more populated states would be paying more, and the less populated states would be paying less. But it would be kind of evenly distributed across the states. Remember, this concept of uniformity really hadn't really started taking form more and more and more until, you know, they finally realized that there's just no easy way. There's all these trappings. You want to, you know, go down property. You want to go down things. You'll always find outliers. That to basically just, you know, create this net of apportionment for taxation, that was the best way. Uniformity being required. And so they finally get to this. But anyway, so it goes and it doesn't pass. It fails on this change, right? And so on the motion, Mr. Randolph, the vote on Saturday... Go ahead. Pick it up from right there.
Okay. The vote on Saturday last authorizing the legislature to adjust from time to time representation upon the principles of wealth and numbers of inhabitants was reconsidered by common consent in order to strike out wealth and adjust the resolution to that requiring periodical revisions according to the number of whites and 3/5 of the blacks. The motion was in the words following: but as the present situation of the states may probably alter in the number of their inhabitants, that the legislature of the U.S. be authorized from time to time to apportion the number of representatives, and in case any of the states shall hereafter be divided, or any two or more states united, or new states created within the limits of the U.S., the legislature of the U.S. shall possess authority to regulate the number of representatives in any of the foregoing cases, upon the principle of their number of inhabitants, according to the provisions hereafter mentioned.
Okay, so they're going down this path of maintaining this apportionment for taxation. And so as we kind of look at, you know, this concept of changing states, merging, or what have, because they said, you know, we don't know how things are going to go. And so there may be states that may want to join together. There may be states that want to break up. And if that's the case, then the federal government or the Congress shall possess the authority to regulate the number of representatives in any of those foregoing cases so that they can make the adjustments appropriately. Now, go ahead, because they're just throwing out these ideas, and many of these ideas, as they start to crawl along, were so weak. In other words, you know, when you're in a brainstorming session, a lot of people throw out ideas, and you know, many of the ideas that come out can't make it to the finish line because the scrutiny that gets thrown at these ideas, well, what about this, and what about this, and what about this? Eventually, this little thing, this idea dies because everybody realizes it's weak. What ends up happening over time is the strong ideas prevail because those that have the least risk, the least problems, you know, ended up withstanding that and making it to the finish line. So that's really how this all came together, but let's go ahead with Governor Morris now.
I thought it was Mr. Butler.
Oh, I'm sorry. Did I miss Mr. Butler? No. So you just covered on the motion of Mr. Randolph, according to the provisions hereafter mentioned. And then it comes to Governor Morris. Mr. Butler is just after that on the next page down. You don't have Governor Morris? So, Mr. Governor Morris stated this. He opposed
Something happened. Yeah, that's fine. Okay, that's fine. Hold on. I gotta bring it up. You go ahead and read it, because
that's fine.
Disappeared on my end.
Okay, so Governor Morris opposed the alteration as leaving still an incoherence. If Negroes were to be viewed as inhabitants, and the revision was to proceed on the principle of numbers of inhabitants, they ought to be added in their entire number and not at the proportion of 3/5. If, as property, the word wealth was right and striking it out would produce the very inconsistency which it was meant to get rid of. The train of business and the late turn which it had taken had led them, he said, into deep meditation on it, and he would candidly state the result. A distinction had been set up, urged between the North and the Southern states. He had hitherto considered this doctrine as heretical. He still thought the distinction groundless. He sees, however, that as it is persisted, and that the Southern gentlemen will not be satisfied unless they see the way to open to their gaining a majority in the public councils, the consequence of such a transfer of power from the maritime to the interior landed interest will, he foresees, be as an oppression of commerce, and that he shall be obliged to vote the vicious principle of equality in the second branch in order to provide some defense for the northern states against it. I'm going to stop right there. You see what he's basically laying out, and this becomes more and more prevalent, that the equality and the sovereignty of the states in the Senate was going to be the way they could keep the Southern states at bay. If they were going to be able to get an advantage by getting the credit for the slaves as for apportionment, for representation, the only way was to ensure that the Senate had this level of hard encoded protection from being able to, you know, squash anything that would come from the House that would give the South an advantage. Now, for some reason, they just did not trust the South. Why is that? Tammy, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. I'm thinking.
Okay. So why is it that the South, because what comes with money? Because the South had the money. What comes with that?
Control.
Power.
Power.
Affluence. Absolutely. So what does power usually do to a person?
Usually corrupts them.
Yeah, there you go. Lord Acton, as a matter of fact, if you go back and you look at how far back Lord Acton made that statement was made back in these men's days. These men were painfully aware that power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. That's when that statement was made. So they understood this, and they wanted to make sure that they were going to create a system that would not allow the corruption to creep from this despicable design of protecting slavery. So moving on, he says, but to come more to the point, either this distinction is fictitious or real. If it's fictitious, let it be dismissed and let us proceed with due confidence. If it be real, instead of attempting to blend incompatible things, let us once take a friendly leave of each other. There can be no end of demands for security if every particular interest is to be entitled to it. The eastern states may claim it for their fishery and for the other objects, as the southern states claim it for their peculiar objects, slavery. They constantly were being nice and whitewashing the fact of, you know, okay, you guys have this despicable labor system called slavery. He goes on and says, in this struggle between the two ends of the Union, what part ought the middle states in point of policy to take? To join the Eastern Brethren according to his ideas? If the Southern states get the power into their hands and be adjoined as they will be with the interior, they will inevitably bring on war with Spain for the Mississippi. This language is already held, the interior country, having no property nor interest exposed on the sea, will be little affected by such a war. He wished to know what security the northern and middle states will have against this danger. It has been said that North and South Carolina and Georgia only will in a little time have a majority of the people of America. They must, in that case, include the great interior country and everything that was to be apprehended from their getting the power into their hands. Now, what I want to do is actually take a quick second. And actually, let's look at the statehood at that point in time of the Constitution. So I'm going to highlight, because he said that South Carolina, North Carolina, which is right here, and Georgia, which is right here, those three states had a sum of 700,000, less than a million, 700,000. When you look at all the other states against those states, right? And there's New Hampshire, Virginia, and there's Rhode Island. The sum was almost 3 million. So I don't see, I think what he was talking about was the growth and the importation of slaves would continue and continue, especially if they were going to get credit for the slaves. We'll stop here. We'll pick it up in our next session. But because we're out of time. But the point is he's already seen that the way things are going, that this corruption, and I don't think he saw, I think he was actually talking about this perpetuating the slavery going westward. And so, folks, we're breaking into these details, but these are the things that don't come out in the ratification base. That's why these are important. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract. and with Republic Review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.